Welcome to Humboldt County Grown, the show where we dig into the stories of the people growing food here in Humboldt County, California. I'm Gwilym Walker, and today we're speaking with Chris Moore from Woody Rhino Farms. Chris runs a diversified farm growing fruits and vegetables, all while prioritizing soil health, biodiversity, and community resilience. We'll talk about his journey, the challenges of small-scale farming, and what it really takes to run a small diversified farm in Northern California. So, Chris, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. This is exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you for our first episode. So let's start at the very beginning, a very good place to start. What brought you to farming?
Oh, I think originally in my early 20s, I found the permaculture design manual, probably in 1999, and was intrigued by the idea of sustainable kind of off-grid living shortly after I had moved to Humboldt. Fast forward, after years of working in restaurant industry and doing watershed restoration, I was feeling a little disillusioned with grant writing and had been diving back into regenerative farming podcasts, regenerative farming books, and was working with a nursery to do native revegetation projects for riparian plantings, and had noticed that he had a lot of land that was just sitting open. He had about 6 acres of their parcel that was idle and fallowed, and we were talking one day, and I said, hey, what are you doing with that? Is there a chance I could, you know, cultivate some vegetables on there and, you know, have a little farm plot? And sure enough, he was like, yeah, come back this weekend. We'll till up a spot, and I've got some deer fencing. Let's have at it. And that would have been summer of 2011.
Okay.
And we started with about a quarter acre of, you know, strawberries and vegetables.
Wow. So pretty small, tiny.
Yeah, tiny. It was not intended to be a market item or like something that we were doing as a business venture. It was, I had a new son who was only 6 months old and a daughter who was about four, and was like, hey, it'd be fun to have some place to go out and grow some food. We had a small yard in town in McKinleyville that was pretty well shaded on the south side, so our crop gardening space was limited, and so this gave us a spot to have like a little family garden plot, and that went that way for probably 2 years. We experimented with a bunch of different vegetables, a bunch of different practices, no-till practices, and what we found was the calla lilies that had been grown there previously were tenacious, and the blackberries were tenacious, and everything we tried to grow was impacted by those plants. And so I had a crazy wild idea to throw some pigs at a small another little chunk of land that he let us use.
Okay. So it's calla lilies and what else?
Mostly blackberries.
And so that was just making they were like weeds too. Impossible to grow anything.
Yeah. And a lot of wild radish, which is common around here as soon as you disturb the ground.
Yep.
But what we found was I really enjoyed working with pigs more than I enjoyed working with vegetables. And it started out as like, oh, we'll grow a few pigs for, you know, ourselves and a few friends.
Yep.
And then what we realized pretty quickly that the feed cost was not sustainable and very, going to make the venture of raising pigs just for our own meat very expensive. And so I started seeking out local waste streams of spent brewer's waste and spent tofu byproduct, okara.
Oh, okay.
And pretty quickly was able to get in contact with two different businesses locally and start taking a percentage of their waste byproduct. And within a year or so, I was taking the majority of that waste product, if not all of the waste product, from some of those businesses. And with that, we were doing a little bit of composting, but I didn't want to be a compost operation. I, And so we ramped up very quickly from, you know, 5 pigs to 30 pigs and started working on how do we do pasture rotation, forest rotations, how do we keep the impact of the pigs on the ground low, while trying to regenerate pasture and good grass production. And we kind of abandoned vegetables altogether. We kept a small strawberry patch for us to eat, but the focus very quickly from 2011 to roughly 2019 was pretty much 100% pork, pastured pork operation.
Okay, so you started as small-scale strawberries, and then that wasn't working because of the weed pressure. So mm-hmm. you got the pigs to fix that.
Yep.
You found you really enjoyed that, but then the cost of that wasn't working. So you were, like, finding alternatives to that.
Yeah, so we were
kind of bring it cost down.
Yeah, what we found was we could avoid purchasing bagged, you know, standard feed for our pigs.
Mm-hmm.
Through a combination of spent brewer's grain, Okara, and then we were also working with a local grocery store taking their produce scraps.
What's Okara?
Okara is the soy pulp that's when they cook the soybean and then squeeze the soy milk to make tofu. You're left with a bean paste. It's often eaten in China and other places as a porridge. It has a really pleasant tofu type aroma within the first 12 hours of it being produced,
mm-hmm.
and then it goes rancid very quickly after that. But it's really high protein, and it has a lot of amino acids that are critical for raising pigs. So brewer's grain alone doesn't have a lot of calories because it's been extracted for the beer making process, and but the combination of the grain with mm-hmm. fiber and protein and a little bit of calories, the Okara, and then we would move them on pasture. Depending on the time of year, we would move twice a day. But it was every other day was probably the longest we would leave them.
Yeah, because they can till it up quick.
Yeah, our goal was typically not to till up ground too hard. We would go in for the first pass and let them go ahead and kind of disc it and till it so that they could root out all the calloli bulbs and tubers,
mm-hmm.
get them onto the surface. And then what we found over time, they would actually eat the root hairs of the callolis, which are technically a toxin to most livestock. They have a salicylic acid, and it causes gastrointestinal issues. But what we found was the pigs were selectively eating certain parts of the callaloli tuber.
So they could tell.
And so they, you know, we kind of thought of it as like, well, maybe it's their own form of medicinal, like deworming or whatever it is that they're eating it for. But
yeah,
they never would eat much, but they would kind of kick them onto the surface and root them up and leave them to desiccate and die. So
yeah,
over
pigs
time,
are smart.
Yeah, over time we saw the pastures go from pretty heavily dominated by invasive grasses, mustard, mm-hmm. And callolies, because it was a callaloli farm previously.
Yep.
To a mix of native grasses, European annual grasses, and some of the mustard greens still mixed in, but we were able to pretty much eradicate the callolies from the fields.
That's pretty incredible. No herbicides and no having to
dig
all the soil out by hand, just using pigs.
Yeah. And we were able to eradicate some scotch broom with them, some jabata grass and pampas grass, which they ate. They thought that was like one of their favorite treats.
Oh, nice.
They would go right to the core of it. So from a background of doing watershed restoration and invasive plant removal and things of that nature, I was like, this is a really cool tool in a farmer's toolbook to use livestock mm-hmm. in a regenerative way and try to restore a site. So in 2016, we purchased a farm down the road from our leased parcel where we had started in 2011, and used the pigs there to reset the whole place. It was dominated by native blackberries, scotch broom and some other invasive plants. And so we were able to use the pigs to start on our smaller 5-acre parcel and clear that space. And we pretty quickly learned that we weren't going to be able to keep the pigs there full time. It was more of a residential part of the neighborhood.
Oh, okay. So
odor.
The pigs getting into people's yards and stuff.
Yeah, pigs getting through fences. Yeah. Pigs, you know, have a smell even if you're moving them a lot. The Okara, as I mentioned, goes pretty rancid. And more than the pigs being stinky, the waste byproducts that we were bringing in, if they're not completely consumed within 48 hours, they have a funk.
Okay.
Like the smell of sour grain
and
the smell of rotting tofu. Even though the pigs still love to eat it, people don't like smelling it. And so we kind of went through our property, cleared it out. We used the pigs for a handful of years on that parcel and set it up to be kind of a wide-spaced civil pasture system with the idea that eventually we'd have some vegetable crops, but not our primary focus. I guess starting in 2018, 2019, somewhere in there, we had some sheep. A friend had some sheep, and he brought sheep onto the property.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2019, our lease at the end of the road, that arrangement that we had had, a handshake agreement for all those years, there was a shift in the way the landowner wanted to manage. Mm-hmm. We had achieved their goals of eradicating the calla lilies on lower fields. And so we were asked, hey, we don't want to continue doing pigs here. You can raise sheep here, but we don't really want to do pigs here. And I looked at it and was like, I don't really want to deal with sheep on a day-to-day basis. I don't want to deal with pigs on my place. And so in 2019, we pivoted pretty quickly to vegetable operation on our home farm. And started expanding that with utilizing no-till practices. We had generated a lot of compost over the course of years with the excess feed. Even when we had all the pigs, we still would generate excess feed and that we turned into high carbon compost. So we had a lot of compost on the farm and started with a pretty much like a lasagna style no-till system.
What was the scale when you went to your after that 5-year lease, like to your new site, how big was it?
We have about 5 acres with about 3 acres of arable land.
Okay.
We started with roughly about 40-by-100-foot blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd put one into production at a time the first couple of years. I think we put just under 1/4 acre into production in 2019.
Right.
While a friend was still raising some sheep on the property. With the pandemic in 2020, in the spring of 2020, we consolidated the sheep off to a different part of the property and sold off a lot of the sheep and put more ground into production. And that brought us just under 1 acre of production. And we utilized the sheep to trample the grasses that we had cultivated through our pasture management, laid down really heavy mulch and spent bedding, and then capped the whole entire thing with compost.
Right. So it's kind of like by the time you started at that, you'd been farming and done enough sites that you kind of knew how to get that land ready and going. And
yeah, we were able to... there was always the intention of doing small rotations of vegetable plots and keeping it more of like a personal thing or raising a specific crop that we would sell in conjunction with our meat sales. But what we found was trying to raise livestock and vegetables on the same parcel, even with good electric fencing and daily rotations and good permanent fencing, there were still mishaps, and livestock was breaking through. They were getting into greenhouses, they were getting into field blocks, and they were impacting our ability to raise vegetables. And so we just kind of made a decision, we're not going to raise livestock on this part, on this parcel where we're at. And I had made the decision I wasn't really looking to be driving around to multiple sites at that time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's difficult when you can't, you know, and you have to make those decisions to not go 100% on something.
Yeah.
And then you have to say, well, is it worth it to go like 50% on livestock, 50% on vegetables? And eventually you have to make that call.
Yeah. Yeah, processing meat is a huge challenge. We went through the first round of Redwood Meat closing back in the mid 2014 era, mm-hmm. I think it's 15. That was a massive impact to our business.
Yep. Just for our listeners who don't know, Humboldt County, we've had some challenges with meat processors out here. We, for a long time, have only had one meat processor that has a USDA inspector on site, which allows farmers to sell their meat commercially to supermarkets and to distributors. And I think pretty recently it shut down. And so now people are sending their meat like 3 or 4 hours out to get processed and then sent back.
Yeah. Yeah. And luckily at that time, Marin Sun Farms had recently purchased the Petaluma facility that's a USDA. And so we were trucking all the way to Petaluma with live animals. I believe people are having to go farther now.
Yeah. Some people are going up to Modesto.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was just one of those decisions where, you know, we were in the middle of the pandemic. We had a lot of meat in the freezer, because we had just slaughtered 30 some odd pigs at the end of 2019.
Mm-hmm.
So we were sitting on a lot of, a stockpile of product, and we kind of made the decision, well, we want to pivot towards a CSA model and we'll focus on vegetable production. We've got this space. I was really into the idea of working in a no-till system. We don't own a tractor. I have a small tilther, you know, a pretty low tech approach to things.
Yep.
That's kind of, we've been evolving with that no-till system, and we've had some challenges with that also. But, you know, that was kind of how we came back full circle to having strawberries and vegetables and still selling our meat. And we haven't ruled out that we'll never go back to raising livestock.
Mm-hmm.
We're, you know, I'm always looking for the right site with the right agreements. And, you know, in hindsight, having a written lease is one of those things that is super valuable.
Yeah. Yeah. Knowing where each party stands and knowing what you agreed to at the beginning and what changes you might have made along the way. Yeah.
And being able to revisit that every year or every 5 years, however it's written up, and just knowing that it's in writing and both parties are clear on what the situation is.
Right. That just makes both people more assured. And I was going to say too, with the pandemic, I mean, that changed so much for people small farming out here. We had problems with supply chains, and I remember during that time CSAs got really popular.
Yeah.
And like, it was, a lot of people looked to small local farms as a way to kind of break through those supply chain obstacles, and also a lot of people felt like safer getting their food from a source that had touched less hands. Or a lot of people, I think, enjoyed the experience of just going to pick up their CSA outside on the farm. And, you know, everyone knows how stressful grocery shopping was then. So it was just, I think, a lot of people, I think, on either side, consumer and producer, kind of made that pivot to small-scale veggie production.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and we had been moving in that direction towards vegetable production, and it was just kind of like a catalyst to push us that direction.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that we were going to back off on our pork production for all of 2020. My wife Amber and I had attended EcoFarm in January of 2020, with the desire to kind of get inspired. That year's had a bunch of focus on no-till, small-scale no-till and large-scale no-till workshops. And so we went with that, you know, going into 2020 with that in mind, like, our farm is going to pivot. We're going to have pork to sell at market. We'll have vegetables to sell at market, and we'll be more diversified. And then we'll be looking for a new lease to raise livestock. With the way things went, you know, we focused more on the vegetable, and we just have maintained that focus on vegetables going forward. There's a simplicity in not having too many operations on a farm. Each operation is kind of its own business. It's like we had chickens, four meat chickens, and that's its own category on the farm. It's its own business in a way. And we had pork, and we had lamb. And,
right.
And at a certain point, it was like, in order to do the things we want to do and do them well, we could focus in and do one or two of those things, not all of the things at once.
Right. I mean, we only have so much time and attention and energy, and you've got, I assume, a life outside of farming as well.
Like I said, I have two kids and a partner, and we like to do other things off the farm, and I operate a consulting business that I write grants and do farm permitting and farm design and watershed restoration projects. So that's ebbed and flowed over the years with, like, the focus on that side of things. But
I'm curious, like, since you've been here since 1999, you said, what's your experience been seeing the impacts of climate change, and how's that affected your views or techniques with agriculture?
Given that I've been on the coast, predominantly between Arcata and McKinleyville. For all those years, I've worked inland a little bit here and there. I had a restaurant job as a sous chef down in Myers Flat for a while. But for the most part, being on the coast, I've seen, you know, we have our foggy days and that sort of thing.
Yep.
But I feel like that over time, I'm seeing the potential for growing more citrus with protection.
Yeah.
And other crops that you see kind of more prominent down in Southern California, you know, or Central California, where our weather, it still can be foggy and cool and damp, and we have our issues with mildew and things like that. But at the same time, we've had a handful of winters where it's not that cold.
Yeah, January's nice now.
Yeah, and, you know, we've always had January fake out, or, you know,
January.
January or the February fake out, and you get that week here or the week there, you know, on a year where, like, a handful of years back when there was the resilient blob of high pressure sitting offshore that we had, like, most of the winter was sunny and nice, cold nights, but I feel like over the last handful of years, we've just seen that our climate at our farm in particularly is pretty moderate, and our chill hours are not as good as they used to be. Which means there's certain crops that we're seeing, like, we have some citrus that's been in the greenhouses that's done really well, and talking with other friends in the general Bay Area of Humboldt Bay, they've got citrus outside that they cover for, you know, a couple nights out of the year, but for the most part, it's doing just fine.
What kind of citrus are people growing outside here?
Meyer lemons is one that you'll see pretty frequently. Yeah. I've seen some Bear's lime more commonly lately. And then I know a handful of folks that have, like, satsumas in their greenhouses. And we have a couple of satsumas in the greenhouses, and we've been trying to kind of just experiment with that sort of thing. You know, our farm is something that needs to generate income and sustain itself. But I have a farm, an off-farm job, and my wife's a teacher, and she has an off-farm job. So our farm is not 100% of our, like, income stream. It's part of our diversified income streams, which does give us some ability to play and experiment with different crops that most people would say there's no way that won't grow. It's right. not a viable option.
But you got a bit of room to take a bit of a bet on things.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I have to be within reason. I don't
just
try
a
not
bit
to
of
go,
a bet.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to go crazy little bets. And have it be completely a waste of my time. But I don't know. That's what keeps it fun. It's like I have the crops that we grow that I know are going to work for us that are steady.
Yeah.
We have some pretty high symphylan pressure, which is a little arthropod that eats the roots of plants, mm-hmm. especially likes certain crops. A lot of the crops that we, you know, it likes zucchini. It really likes yep. Brassicas. It loves cauliflower within the brassicas more than anything we
right.
found.
And that's what grows best on the coast here is brassicas.
Yes. Yeah. So we've found that certain Asian greens, bok choy and a handful of other similar, they're our best go-to crops. They're fast.
Mm-hmm.
We typically are focusing on our farm on small lettuce mixes, salads. We have a handful of different head lettuce that we grow, and then we try to keep crops to like under 45 days.
So
for the most
keep
part.
It real short.
Yeah, shorter is better, is what we found for our place.
Why is that?
A mix of the symphylan pressure. If we find that they're okay. impacting that crop, we can start over in another bed and hope that, you know, they're not as bad in that location
mm-hmm.
and rotate in something else into that bed that's pretty heavy symphylan. And also our longer crops, we have a really heavy gopher population, and no matter how much we trap, the longer the crop, the more risk I have of losing that crop to gopher predation.
I see, yep.
Yeah. And so we've just found that quicker rotations and being able to flip the beds and start over works really well. This is the first year we've ever really tilled any of our ground.
Oh, okay.
Prior years, it was all done with broadfork, tilther, and auscultation tarps.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd black out the ground, kill the weeds.
Yep.
It's and then
kind
once...
of classic small-scale no-till system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it has its upsides. It's also pretty limiting, and it's pretty labor-intensive.
Broad forking, yeah.
Yeah.
That's tough.
And we're fortunate. We have a silty loam soil. It's uplifted marine terrace.
Mm-hmm.
We probably have close to, like, 5 to 6 feet of topsoil before we hit, like, a sandy base layer.
Nice.
So we're well-drained. Broad forking allows us to get in pretty early,
mm-hmm.
Typically. But over the last handful of years, we've found that the symphylan pressure on the early end of the season means that we can have a lot of crop failure.
Do you think that's related with like the high organic matter and low yes. compaction?
Yeah, our soil tests that have come back over the last handful of years have us at between 12% and 15% organic
wow.
matter, which is pretty high.
Yeah, I think when I was farming out east, good soils out on an organic farm, people were aiming for like 10 at most was considered like awesome.
Yeah. And I think symphylans, you know, it's known that symphylans love organic matter. That's they eat the organic matter, but they eat the roots of the plants.
Yep.
And it gives them the ability to move throughout the soil column really well.
It's perfect little biome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we kind of set ourselves up inadvertently mm-hmm. through our practices to promote symphylan habitat.
Right.
It wasn't a known issue going in.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a blindside. It was talking to a couple other farmers locally and then talking with a farmer out of the area. And when it was like, oh, that's what's happening to us. That's why the spinach beds have these like zones of tiny plants that never grow. And, you know,
oh.
And I started looking at things and then I started digging into the soil and
yeah.
looking and like, oh, there's this symphylan, this cute little white bug that's going to run away from you as fast as it possibly can.
Yeah, well, you might have just solved my backyard spinach problem because I had stunty, runty little spinach and I've grown the best spinach ever on the coast out here. Yeah. But my garden I moved into a year ago, it's just...
If it's runties. Stunted and doesn't seem to grow, a lot of times that's what you're going to find. that it's probably some Sinn Feilins.
And can you see them when you pull them out?
Yeah, they're very small. They're like maybe the quarter of the diameter of a grain of rice, but they're bright white.
Okay.
And if they're in a beet patch, they're going to be white with a red belly. But otherwise, they're white, and they move incredibly fast.
Okay.
And there's not a whole lot you can do about them. You know, tillage is one way to impact them, like if you till right at before planting.
Yep.
Compaction. And then there's some anecdotal evidence that spring oats and potatoes have a tendency to, like, deter them for the next planting.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, most of the studies coming out of UC Davis and University Extension is they're inconclusive, and most say that more studies are needed,
mm-hmm.
but studying Sinn Feilins is incredibly hard because they're so mobile in the soil system. So they're not an easy thing to study.
Right. So with the organic controls, you're kind of limited to just physically messing up their environment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, for our cucumbers, you know, we put cucumbers in, and what we'll often do is we'll kind of either heel them in really tight with our hands, or we'll actually walk into the bed and step around them really carefully to create some compaction right around the planting.
Oh, okay.
It's counterintuitive to, like, broad forking and all this, you know, light impact on the soil to try and create aerated soil, but given our soil structure and soil
mm-hmm.
type, that's what we found. And talking with other farmers locally that have had similar Sinn Feilin pressures, that's kind of the go-to, is like, go ahead and be a little bit more firm than you would normally be.
You've been good to your soil for so many years.
Yeah.
Ultimately,
all the compost we added and all of the layering and pasture rotation, all of the area we cultivate on has been grazed at, you know, anywhere from probably 50 to 100 plus times of rotations over the years.
Yeah.
Just in our tenure, because we're moving so fast.
Wow. It makes me, I'm wondering, so we talked a lot about challenges,
mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering what your biggest one, would you say, of the past 11 years has been, whether it's related to the climate or regulations or just, like, keeping up with everything.
Time is often the biggest challenge.
Time management?
Pressures. You know, pest pressure is pest pressure. I think every farm has some pest that's going to cause you an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But time and having enough labor to do all the work and having enough cash flow to pay for labor if my time is not available.
Yeah.
I think as a small farm with, you know, not a minimal amount of production, but not a huge amount of production.
Mm-hmm.
An acre is not a huge amount of ground to produce, like, a living on.
Mm-hmm.
And so the costs to manage that, we try to do a lot of the work ourselves between Amber and I.
Yep.
But occasionally we need more help. And so bringing someone in to help makes the farm more effective and more efficient. But then you start looking at that cost basis of, like, well, if
mm-hmm.
I'm paying a lot of labor time, that's great, we're getting a lot of work done, but are we actually sustainable? Am I subsidizing that labor force with off-farm income?
Yeah.
And sometimes that's a balance. You know, like I said, I have an off-farm job with my consulting business and grant writing. And so there's often times where I can't be on the farm because I have to be doing other projects.
Yeah. So you have to make those compromises.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's time tracking, making sure that we've got, I'm like doing some time analysis on how much time I'm spending on each activity. And,
okay.
And then giving myself the grace to be like, oh, well, yeah, you spent this many hours on this project, not on this, on the farm. The farm looks like it got that many hours this week. That's what it is.
Well, speaking of time tracking, we're kind of getting close to the end here. So
yeah.
I want to do rapid fire, final thoughts. So what is your favorite crop to grow?
Oh.
You have to pick one.
Gosh. It's a toss-up between shisho and bok choy, honestly. It might be bok choy.
Okay.
Yeah, baby bok choy is probably one of my favorites. There's a lot of repetitions that you can get in a year. So you can have...
How quick from seed to harvest of the baby bok choy out here?
This time of year, the variety we have right now, 28 to 30 days.
Really?
Yeah. So it's planted every week, generally. It's the way I try to do it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's fun to be able to have something that, like, you can have multiple crops that are really, really good, and then you'll have one that's a complete mess. But you know within a week you've got something coming right behind it.
Yeah. And a lot of chances to figure it out. Like, what went wrong and hone it down.
Yeah. And then people's reaction at market to, like, little baby bok choy is just...
Yeah.
It's pretty amusing, and
yep.
I enjoy how much people like it. And it's one of the things I like to eat the most.
Yeah, the little cute vegetables always taste better, in my opinion, at least. Okay, what's the biggest farming win this year, or in the past year, maybe?
Gosh. Biggest farming win. Maybe just accepting the fact that, like, the output of the farm is equal to the input that I'm giving it.
You're at, like, a net zero? I'm feeling good about that?
Yeah, and being okay with, like, yeah, this is the energy I put in is going to equal this much output. Mm-hmm. And not having the same unrealistic expectations that I used to have, where it's like, well, why isn't the farm doing 100% more when I'm only giving it 20% of my time?
Right. So your efficiencies now are kind of meeting your more realistic expectations.
Yeah.
And you know what you're kind of capable of.
Bringing some new tools onto the farm, having a paper pot transplanter over the last 2 years has been a game changer.
Okay.
Yeah.
I've messed with those before. I've really had trouble not getting the chain to break. I'm sure is everybody's big troubleshooting. And so my next rapid-fire question, what's one tool you can't farm without?
Can't farm without.
Could you farm without the paper pot planner?
We have farmed without the paper pot planner. I don't think I would want to farm.
Go back?
I wouldn't want to go back to farming without a paper pot. I wouldn't want to farm without a Jang cedar.
Okay. What about an Earthway cedar?
Oh, those can... go to hell. I do not like the Earthway cedar. I can't imagine. Yeah, the Jang cedar is so worth the cost, and it's not even that much more expensive at the end of the day, for the amount of seed that you're not wasting, for the amount of time you're not wasting,
the efficiency,
the versatility. That's been our main tool for most of our crops. We do a ton of direct seeding, and that the Jang has made that all happen. I think I only pull out an Earthway for peas, and the rest of the year it's sitting collecting dust.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, last question. What's the best meal you've made from your farm?
Well, recently my son had a ramen competition for school.
Oh, cool.
And so we took some of the last of our pork bones.
Oh, nice.
And some chicken feet, and made a tonkatsu broth, and then we had all of the vegetables from the farm, and then we had also made some green onion kimchi.
Oh,
so
wow.
It ended up being like all the vegetables and the broth was from our farm, and sadly we didn't have any pork belly to make our own to add, but we had ramen eggs that were our own eggs. And yeah, that's kind of a farm go-to for us. It's like with some bok choy or some choy sum, the green onions, our farm fresh eggs that are marinated, and then a really good broth.
Oh my god, you want? I'm gonna maybe make some ramen today now.
Yeah, that's one of our favorites on the farm.
So for our listeners, where can they find Woody Rhino's products, and do you have any socials you want to share, or social medias?
I have not been very good about sharing the farm on social media as of late. And we haven't really been at market much this year either, to be honest. We've sold primarily through our restaurant partners, selling to the Eatery in Trinidad and to Beachcomber in Trinidad, and then also partnering with Sea Goat Farm Stand.
Oh, right. Nice. I love those folks.
Right now, that's kind of where our products are at. Our salad mix is featured at the Eatery, along with we have head lettuce that we sell to them, Little Jim's, herbs, and other things. We'll have green beans and cucumbers going to them in the next couple of weeks, and our bok choy goes to them pretty regularly as well. But yeah, we'll be back at market hopefully soon.
Which market?
Arcata Saturday Market is where we'll be.
Okay.
Primarily.
Right on. Well, Chris, thank you so much for coming in and talking farming. And
absolutely.
Always love having you in. Next week, we're going to be talking about the NCGA's Food Hub, which is a distribution site we have here in Humboldt County. And until then, eat well and support your local farmers.